Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass f-. So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Hello and welcome to the History of Russia. As usual, I'm Damon and this is episode 15, Fragmentation and Decline. Thanks for listening in. Last week, we went slightly off-piste and took a look at the Byzantine Emperor's personal bodyguard, the Varangian Guard, which from its formation in the late 900s until the Fourth Crusade in the early 1200s was mainly made up of Varangians or Rus and the Anglo-Saxons. This week, we're back with the main story and looking at the fragmentation of the Kievan Rus and the effective demise of Kiev. But before we start, there's just a couple of things that I want to mention. And first of all, I've got a correction to make. At the beginning of some of the episodes, I like to start the main narrative off with a rousing Paidiom, which means let's go in Russian, or at least I thought it did. And well, it sort of half does. Well, how did I find this out? Well, it's all down to Victor from St. Petersburg, who pointed out to me that Paidiom would normally be used in instances where you were actually physically going somewhere, like the theatre or a restaurant, for example. The correct term for the more general let's go is a word that's spelt, well, in Roman script anyway, P-O-E-K-H-A-L-I. So it sounds like pokhali, but from what I can make out, it's pronounced pokhaya. So thanks, Victor. That's very much appreciated. Secondly, big thanks go out to Gom JSK, Were Doomed, and Alex Avdakov for following the podcast. Alec is a podcaster himself. He's currently doing a podcast on the life and times of Frederick the Great, somebody I know very little about, so I've joined up, followed, and I'm listening to it, and it's a great little podcast. Thanks to all of them for following my podcast. And then thirdly, I've got a bit of a moan, or, well, a moan stroke confession. Because there's certain periods of history that no matter how much I read or study, I just can't get my head around. And even if I think I do understand things, a couple of weeks or sometimes days later, I inevitably find out that very little of what I've read has stuck. And classic examples of this for me are the Spanish Civil War, the whole Cromwell and the English Republic thing, the 30 Years' War, which is a nightmare, and the Irish struggle for independence. And I'm not altogether sure what the main reasons for this ineptitude on my part are, although I guess most of it could be down to lots of unfamiliar names, a complex series of events, and maybe contradictory sources. Well, there's now another one to add to my list, because when I was preparing my notes for this episode, I had that sinking feeling, and sure enough, when I went back to what I had written, it was all a bit of a muddle and lacked a degree of clarity. Which is strange, because up until now I found it relatively straightforward to come up with a way of weaving together and simplifying the main themes of each of the historical periods that I'm covering. But mid to late 12th century Kievan Rus has, to be honest, proved to be a struggle. So, what I've decided to do is strip back on the plethora of people that are involved and try to keep everything as simple as possible. And I'm going to break this episode, which covers the period between 1132 and 1170, into four main components. So number one, we'll look at the sub-princedoms. Number two, the people in charge of Kiev. Three, the fragmentation of the Rus state and the end of Kievan control. And finally, a quick look at one of the sub-princedoms. and then I'll wrap everything up at the end. But enough, Damon. You lot haven't taken the time to listen to this episode to hear me banging on about how difficult it was to put everything together. And so, without further ado, pokaia! So first of all, let's do some scene setting and look at the way that the Rus lands were divided up into the various provinces or sub-princedoms. Now, I've mentioned some of these before, like Chernigov, Novgorod and Pereyaslav. But there are others I haven't told you about, so let's go through them all. And actually, if you want help visualising where they are, a couple of weeks ago I posted a map up on the website, which is historyofrussia.podbean.com. Okay, so broadly going from south to north, we have the princedoms of Halych, or sometimes it's spelt Gallic with a G, and Volyn, which are both to the west of Kiev. Then you've got Kiev itself, and then Chernigov and Pereyaslav to the east of Kiev. Then going up a bit, in the middle of the Rus lands, above Kiev, we find Polotsk and Smolensk. And then further to the north of those, we have Novgorod and Rostov-Suzdal, the latter being later referred to as Vladimir-Suzdal, or sometimes Vladimir-Rostov-Suzdal. And then finally, out to the east of Chernigov, so in the far east of the Rus lands, we find the princedom of Murom-Ryazan, or sometimes it's just called Ryazan. So that makes 9 in total, 5 in the south, 2 in the middle, 2 in the north, and 1 stuck out to the east. However, just to confuse matters, some sources state that there are 12, but that's because they count Murom-Ryazan and Vladimir-Rostov-Suzdal as separate entities. Okay, so why have I basically just run through a list of places? Well, for reasons that I've been hinting at for the past couple of episodes and the title of this one, Kiev is going to become less important, while some of the other princedoms are going to become more important, and in particular, Novgorod and Vladimir-Rostov-Suzdal. Actually, I'm just going to call it Vladimir, I think, from now on. But don't worry about Kiev. It's still going to be there. Well, it's there today. And it will still be of historical, religious and cultural importance to the Rus and the Russians, Belarusians and Ukrainians who we've yet to meet. It just won't be as key or central as it once was. A bit like London. Okay, so that's the geography sorted. Now let's take a look at some of the key people who are around in the time period we're covering. So remember, we've just been through the reigns of Vladimir Monomakh and his son Mstislav I. Now between the death of Mstislav I in 1132 and the death of his grandson Mstislav II in 1170, there were 20 changes of either grand prince or regime. And I mentioned grand prince or regime because some of the rulers, well in fact nearly all of them, had multiple goes at being in charge. I'll run through them quickly and they fit into 3 broad groupings. So to begin with, we've got Vladimir Monomakh's other sons who are all brothers of Mstislav I or the Great. So we have Yaropolk II, Vyacheslav, and Yuri Dolgoruki, who we met a couple of weeks ago. Now both Vyacheslav and Yuri were in charge 3 times each. And some sources point out that at the end of Yuri's 3rd time in charge in 1157, that Kiev was effectively finished as the foremost power in the Rus lands. But we'll cover all of that in a few minutes. Then we have the descendants of Mstislav I. So his sons Izyaslav II, who again was in charge 3 times. Same for Rostislav, and then finally his grandson Mstislav II. And then finally there were the grandsons of Sviatopolk II, who remember was a junior member of the triumvirate that we spoke about, well, I think it was 3 weeks ago now. And that's Vsevolod II, Igor II, and Izyaslav III. And Izyaslav III had 3 goes as well. And then we've got one other important player to mention, and that's a character called Andrei Bogolyubsky, who was Yuri Dolgoruki's son. So I don't expect you to remember all of those, and that's why I haven't gone through each one of the, I don't know, 10 or 12 of them who were in charge 20 times in great detail. So that's the places and names out the way. So let's now take a look at what actually happened in some of these places to the key people I've just mentioned. So the chronicles state that the last ruler to maintain a united Rus state centered in Kiev, and that's the important bit, was Mstislav the Great, or the Busy, as I referred to him a couple of episodes ago. And after his death in 1132, Kievan Rus fell into recession and a rapid decline. And Mstislav's successor, his brother, Yaropolk II, instead of focusing on the external threat of the Cumans, yeah, they're still around, but as far as I can see, are they that much of an external threat? Well, let's see. Yaropolk got himself involved in a conflict with the growing power of the moment, his brother Yuri Dolgoruki, or, if you remember, Yuri the Far-Reaching. Well, Yaropolk got himself involved in a conflict? That's a little unfair, as we'll soon see.
There's never been a faster or easier way to start your weight loss journey than with PlushCare. PlushCare accepts most insurance plans and gives you online access to board-certified physicians who can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Take charge of your health and speak with a board-certified physician about a weight loss plan that's right for you. Get started today at PlushCare.com/weightloss. That's PlushCare.com/weightloss. PlushCare.com/weightloss.
First though, a bit of background on Yuri. I've mentioned him, well, in this episode and a couple of weeks ago. In 1108, Vladimir Monomakh sent his young son nominally to govern the Rostov Principality. In 1121, Yuri quarrelled with the boyars of Rostov and moved the capital of his lands from that city to Suzdal, hence Rostov-Suzdal. And as the area was sparsely populated, Yuri established many towns and fortresses, and as I've already mentioned previously, one of the towns was called Moscow, allegedly. Well, not that it wasn't called Moscow, it's just we're not certain that Yuri founded it. And you'll have noticed the mention of the word boyar or boyar there for the first time in the podcast. And it's simply a Russian generic term for nobles or the aristocracy. Okay. But for Yuri, life in Suzdal was all a bit of a sideshow, and he wanted to be wielding power in the centre of things. And to do that, he needed to be in Kiev. So the sources tell us that as soon as big brother Mstislav died, he declared war on his other brother, Yaropolk II. See, I told you it wasn't Yaropolk's fault. And if that wasn't enough, he also decided to declare war on the princedom of Chernigov for good measure. And it's for this meddling in southern Rus affairs that he gets his nickname, Dolgoruki. And just while we're on the subject, the Dolgoruki were a famous family in the time of the Tsars, rising to prominence in the 17th century. And whilst I haven't been able to find 100% that, you know, Yuri is the ancestor, it is possible that he was the founder of the house. And he's not just involved in fighting in Kiev and Chernigov. He's also got his long arms wrapped around his father's lands in Pereyaslav, and up in the north, he enthroned one of his sons as the Prince of Novgorod. And then in 1140, Dolgoruki went for the big one, captured Kiev and installed himself as the Grand Prince. But as previously intimated, not everything went to plan, and on two occasions he totally lost his grip and was driven out of Kiev. But he's nothing other than a determined character, and he returned in 1155 for one last go. Unfortunately though, this only lasted for 2 years, and in 1157 he died, probably from poison. And it's at this point that everything imploded into full-on civil war between the different Rus princedoms. And whilst nominally there was still a Grand Prince in Kiev for the next 12 years, or several Grand Princes, in reality the game was up for the city on the Dnieper. Okay, so that's the end of Uri, but I'll continue the story through the arc of his son, whose name about 5 minutes ago I completely butchered, so let's have another go. Andrei Bogolyubsky. Now, Andrei spent his early years in Vyshgorod, near Kiev, but in 1155 we find him up in Vladimir, and upon his father's death in 1157, he became the prince of the newly named province or princedom of Vladimir Rostov-Suzdal. But I said I was only going to call it Vladimir, so sorry about that. Vladimir. With his new authority and power, he at first tried to reunite the Rus, trying desperately to bring Novgorod back into the fold, and more about Novgorod later. And he used the old stick and carrot approach in the southern princedoms. And what do I mean by stick and carrot? Well, stick means fighting and carrot means diplomacy. And his stock must have been rising, because in 1162 he was able to send an embassy to Constantinople, which lobbied for a separate metropolitan see to be established in Vladimir. And just in case you're wondering, a metropolitan is a rank in the Orthodox Church above an archbishop. Well, it is in the Russian Orthodox Church anyway. Back in the southern princedoms, however, things were not going so well, maybe down to too much use of the carrot and not enough use of the stick. And so, running out of patience, in 1169, Andrei, with a coalition of princes, sacked Kiev, devastating it as never before. And the city was plundered of most of its religious artwork and treasure, much of which was transported back to Vladimir, which coincidentally had recently been strengthened and fortified, and was now essentially the new capital of the Rus princedoms, with one major exception, which we'll come on to. But he doesn't get to enjoy his new capital city for long, because like his father, he doesn't get on with his boyars. And all of this leads to a series of schemes and plots, which came to a head in 1174, when a group of assassins broke into his chambers and murdered him in his bed. So another sticky end, but between them, Yuri and Andrei have shifted the centre of power away from Kiev and eastwards to Vladimir. And by the way, you're probably wondering why Andrei was called Bogolyubsky. Well, there's no great mystery to it. He had built a castle just outside of Vladimir, and it was referred to as Bogolyubovo, and it's from that he got his nickname. So the one major exception that I think I've mentioned a couple of times was Novgorod. Now, Novgorod had always been a bit different. If you remember, it was the original HQ or capital of the first Varangians as they forged their trading networks down the Dnieper and Volga rivers. And no doubt when Kiev became the capital, because it was closer to the main trading centre Constantinople, you would have expected Novgorod to become a bit of a fringe player. But it didn't. It maintained most of its importance as it controlled the onward distribution of Byzantine trade goods back to the Scandinavian homelands, particularly those that came up the Volga, so bypassing Kiev. And because it was so large and it was a border town, its people maintained a large degree of independence. And as early as 1014, Novgorod was effectively self-governing and had built up a highly efficient, financially sound, quasi-democratic series of institutions. And to protect itself, it had built in 1044 its own Kremlin, or Detinets. And then a year later, it had its first cathedral, St. Sophia, which became the main place of worship for the northern Rus lands due to its beautiful architecture and great size. In 1136, so right at the beginning of the period we're covering, a type of early republic was set up in the state of Novgorod. Yes, there was still a prince, mainly for military and defensive purposes, but there were also elections, and if the prince didn't rule in accord with the elected officials, he'd soon find himself in hot water, and in some cases, marched out of the city. So I'll cover Novgorod in further detail at some point, because it is a fascinating place, and in the future, it does have an increasing role to play. But for now, I just wanted to give you a flavour of the place and why it was so different. So, All of that is a simplified, condensed version of a complex series of events that led to the decline of Kiev, the rise of Vladimir, and the quasi-independence of Novgorod. But I think you have to sit back and ask yourself, why did all of this happen? And the answer is the usual one. It's simple. It's greed. Greed for money and greed for power. And the underlying reasons were a breakdown in central power and economic decline. And there's a further question. I mean, at the end of this, what's really changed? And on a macro scale, not a lot. Most of the people, outside of the princes, their retinues, the boyars and the clergy, continue to live their, well, pretty mundane lives, generally unaffected by whether or not they were ruled from Kiev, Vladimir or Novgorod. No doubt some of them had served in the various armies, and no doubt some of them were injured and died. But on the whole, life continued much as it ever had. So I like to think of it in terms of the following. Imagine you've got a big old-fashioned birdcage. It contains 12 birds, all sitting on separate perches. Something gives the cage a great big shake, and that something, or the shake, equals the Cumans, the Apennine system, and the decline of Byzantine trade. There's then a load of squawking and flapping, but finally the birds calm down. But now they've all ended up on different perches. So, same cage, same birds, different perches, and a load of mess and feathers. And that about sums it all up. Okay, let's leave it there for this week. Next time we'll be taking a look at how the Grand Princes of Vladimir get on with their time in the sun, and also exploring the question, what's going on with the Cumans? Just before I go, if you want to get in touch with a comment or question via the website, historyofrussia.podbean.com, via Twitter at historyrussia1, or via email, nordicworld@outlook.com. Okay then, until next time, stay safe, look after yourselves, and I'll see you all soon.
When you make decisions for your company, you look for the no-brainers. And if you have a lot of mailing to do, Stamps.com is the ultimate no-brainer. It streamlines your processes to make your business more efficient, which makes you less busy. Mail checks, invoices, legal documents, and everything you need to keep your business running with Stamps.com. Seamlessly connect with every major marketplace and shopping cart. Schedule package pickups and see your cheapest and fastest shipping options from different carriers. With rates up to 89% off USPS and UPS rates. And with the Stamps.com mobile app, you can take care of mailing and shipping wherever you are. Make the same no-brainer decision as over 1 million other businesses with Stamps.com. Sign up with code PROGRAM for a 4-week trial, plus free postage and a free digital scale. No long-term commitments or contracts. That's Stamps.com. Code Program.